From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
Hi, I'm Dan Savage. Don't tell me that not all Christians are anti-gay bigots. Tell that to all the so-called anti-gay Christian leaders out there who claim to speak for all Christians.
One of the most frustrating misperceptions in today's culture wars is the belief that homosexuality and religious faith do not mix. The fact is that a wide range of welcoming and affirming religious groups are actively reaching out to LGBT persons. A new attempt to counter this misperception is the website Not All Like That. It's the brainchild of writer John Shore, and he'll be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
These two issues, you look at Syria, you look at Obamacare, and they're tied together.
It was last summer. Obama drew the red line yesterday. No, I didn't. I didn't do that.
The question is, what is the political and military landscape?
Absolutely, he needs congressional approval.
Maybe it's not something that was ever possible, deciding on American military intervention overseas without escalated discussion of domestic politics, but we've certainly seen more than our fair share of that discussion as the Obama administration and Congress weigh the options for what should be done in Syria. George Washington University's Greg LaBelle will be here to share his firsthand knowledge of the influence politics can have on such a moment. But first,
Syrian activists have accused government troops of launching a gas attack in what would be the worst reported use of chemical weapons in the two-year civil war.
It has tested positive for signatures of sarin.
I have absolutely no doubt this was a chemical weapons attack.
The enormity of the crisis in Syria is difficult to overstate, and just as difficult to understand. What we can do is focus on people who, at great personal risk, are doing important work to bring some of the opposing factions together. One organization that has long taken the lead in such vital work around the globe is Religions for Peace, the largest international coalition of representatives from the world's great religions dedicated to promoting peace. And joining me now is Religions for Peace Secretary General Dr. William Vinley. Dr. Vinley, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, welcome. I'm always pleased to be with you and with all the people that are on your program listening with you.
You literally are just stepping off a plane from Jordan where you've been talking with religious leaders. You're working with people who don't make the headlines, but they're committed to defusing some of the deadly tensions in that region through peaceful means.
I think we need to look at Syria as the center of a circle. You really can't see Syria and the drama there unless you place it in its neighborhood. And the conflicting, pulling tensions within that neighborhood. Syria herself is torn apart. She's simply suffering to the point of almost breaking up. Daily life is just unbearable at the present time. There is the area controlled by the Bashar regime, and there's the area that is not in his control and in various states of either militias or groups in control, but not very well united. And it's in that terrible situation that the population is struggling to live, and, of course, suffering intense violence on a daily basis, and people desperately trying to get out if they can. We need to understand that in that part of the world, the great Islamic tradition is identifiable by two different streams. I'm generalizing here, but those Muslims, the majority, who call themselves Sunnis, and among the states that would be pertinent here would be Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and even Egypt. And then those Muslims who understand themselves as Shia, and these would be predominantly associated with Iran. Now, there is a political contest under the surface of this that is driving this conflict in a very significant way, and the Syrian people are caught in the cross pull of this.
I think it's safe to say that in the West, we get a fairly simplistic narrative regarding Syria. What is it that you think we don't understand about this conflict that we really need to know?
Well, Tim, I think there is no chance of a decisive military resolution of this conflict. Pushing the military option will push us further and further towards a completely collapsed state. So that's not a resolution. That's a complete failure in which the worst of chaotic situations and even the violent nurturing takes place. So we need a political resolution. If that was the case, we would have to ask ourselves who would have to sit down in order to get that political resolution. And here's what I'm pointing to in answer to your question. In addition to the groups within Syria herself, meaning the regime headed by Bashar al-Assad, and also the motley and not really unified oppositional forces, we would also need to bring the Iranians, the Saudis, probably the Egyptians, and here, in addition, other actors, the Russians, who have a very significant vision of their presence in Syria, and, of course, the United States and probably Europeans. There really is a need, beyond any military response, to think in terms of a comprehensive conference, political conference. Each of these powers that I mentioned has a stake in this conflict. They have interests in this conflict in addition to the humanitarian concerns that are genuine, I believe. And to get it solved, we're going to have political brilliance and leadership to try to bring those actors to a common table. The military stuff is going to burn until we do.
If I am understanding you correctly, you don't want to see any further military action take place, rather a convening of the proper people at the political table to work out a nonviolent solution.
That's right. And even for people, and I know there are very sincere people who read of people being gassed by chemical weapons and immediately think of the terms of protection, and that's a completely understandable reaction. It's one that I find within myself as well. The point here is that any idea that a punitive military action, understandable as that might be, in isolation from an even larger effort at getting the political table set, that military option in isolation is going to produce unpredictable consequences. And people have different views, sincere people have different views, on the legitimacy of that. But my point is one I think that can appeal to people across a wider spectrum. Let's not isolate military discourse. When we have military discourse, it's always tragic. It means we haven't succeeded. But minimally, let's couple it to the real task at hand, which is to get the inner circle, those are the Syrians, and the second circle, those are her neighbors, and then maybe even a third circle, the large powers like Russia, the United States, the Europeans, into a peace conference. And there's going to be trade. And these are painful for people. But when we look at the forces aligned, this is the way forward for us.
Well, Bill, I know that this interview did not come easily for you because you just stepped off a plane from Jordan, and a lot of people never get to hear a real peacemaker. And we hear the political side, we hear the moral debates, we hear all the geopolitics, But you've talked about what has to be done and how to do it, and you just give us hope because there is a peacemaker like you in the world. And I thank you for taking time to talk with us on State of Belief, and I thank you even more for what you do for humankind around the world.
Well, Tim, thank you. And we've had a long, long professional association and deep friendship. We both know that no matter where we are in the world, people can, and they can do this in their own way, people can pray for peace. And all of your followers, the people listening in your program, I think this is the time for all of us in profound solidarity with people who would be just like us if we happened to be there, to be united in this very tough hour. That makes a difference to the people struggling so hard.
Thank you, Dr. Venley, very much.
Thank you, Elton.
Later on in this week's show, Not All Like That, a new resource offering LGBT people a message of support from people of faith. Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University and a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg's deep knowledge of the way Washington really works is particularly valuable in times of turmoil, and I'm so very happy that he is in the studio with me right now. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Nice to be here, Welton. Thank you.
Greg, if one of the candidates for whom you worked was elected president and you were in the White House and he calls you in and says, here's the situation, it's Syria, what all do I need to be thinking about? What does the president need to be taking into consideration right now?
I think there are so many levels at which this has to be considered. And I think this president recognizes this, which in a way is what creates this challenge for him, because there is at its core that ethical question about what is our proper role. What is the proper role of the community of nations in this situation? Are we at a point where we simply cannot be silent anymore? Overlaid on that are all of the political aspects, both international and domestic, that come into play. Our relationship with Russia right now, how we deal with our close friends like Great Britain and Germany and France. And then, once again, back to that question of how does the president deal with a Congress that has been at best not interested in working with him in a number of situations. That's all part of the equation here.
Did the president make the situation more complex than he had to by bringing Congress into it?
Probably.
And why did he do it?
Well, and I think it gets back to this president's recognition of the layers that are involved here. I think his hand was forced a little bit by what happened in the British Parliament.
Yes.
Looking at that, I think they in the White House recognized that there was some value on an international scale for being able to say that we were going in because these two branches of government agreed. I also think that the president probably saw this as an opportunity to engage Congress and I'd say particularly the House of Representatives in what would be for the first time in a very long time, I think, an actually substantive discussion of public policy, which has not been the norm over the last couple of years.
I've found myself pleased that he did this because you at least have a sense that there is a dialogue going on. And it's not just the people around the president that are making the decision. I felt good about that. Second thing I felt good about, Greg, was it thrills me. I mean, I'm not on this subject, but it thrills me to see Republicans arguing with each other and Democrats arguing with each other and Democrats and Republicans coming together in their opinions, stepping out of that just, you know, solid, we're always going to be where we are. I'm glad to see that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that what we are seeing here is divisions not just between the parties but within the parties. And many of these divisions have to do with principle. Thank God we're actually back at some point talking about some principles here. I agree with you. I think that the president going to Congress and starting this conversation is a healthy thing.
this has gone well and will go well if Congress gives him support. If they don't give him support and he's still dedicated to going, then we've got another whole thing on our hands.
Yes. You know, and there are a couple of things that can happen. I mean, he could win support in the Senate and not in the House. Obviously, he could win support in both houses, or he could win no support in either house. If he loses in one or both houses, it does present some interesting challenges. It certainly chips away at his ability to get things done. He's investing a great deal in this. And this is an investment that I think the administration had hoped to be making in immigration reform, possibly still in gun control legislation, certainly in the budget and the debt, all of which is being expended right now on the situation in Syria.
You mentioned taking into consideration Russia. How can Russia stand up for the Syrian administration in light of what's happened there?
Well, again, this is geopolitics. This is geopolitics in a way that in some ways we haven't seen since the end of the Cold War. This is Vladimir Putin putting himself in a position to be the anti-American leader. I mean, this is certainly what the motivation I think was around Edward Snowden, taking him in, and I think this continues this approach that Putin seems to be taking to geopolitics. I don't understand it. I'm not sure what he gains or what the country of Russia gains by taking this position, but that certainly seems to be the piece that he's carved out here.
Greg, the recent virtual collapse of Libya hasn't made it to the front pages because of Syria, but it's just the latest example of the aftermath of short-term foreign intervention. Can you think of an instance short of World War II where the United States gets involved demonstrably with a positive outcome?
I would say it's very difficult in the 20th and 21st century, as you say, but post-World War II, I think to think of an instance where the result was what we intended it to be or presented it as likely to be. Mm-hmm. No, from Korea through Vietnam and on to the present day. No, I don't think there is an instance when we have accomplished what it was we said we set out to accomplish.
Yeah. Greg, in one way it feels almost dirty to talk about politics at a time when so many lives are being lost in Syria, but we can't deny that politics still plays a huge role in the kind of the decision a president has to make at a time like this.
We have to start, I think, with the fact that this president is in his second term. We are racing headlong toward midterm elections. This is a point at which second-term presidents achieve lame duck status. Presidents try in their second terms, in most cases, to build on the accomplishments of their first terms. I think this president went into the second term with a more aggressive agenda. I think that politically, the Democratic Party still holds on to the hope that they can maintain control of the United States Senate after 2014 and possibly, I think it's turnover of 17 seats, which would give them the House of Representatives, which would give this president a second chance at accomplishing some of the things he's wanted to accomplish since the passage of health care reform and so forth. This takes a lot of wind out of that. This president has to spend a tremendous amount of political capital on this to move it along. So that draws some serious questions as to in terms of what he can accomplish beyond this. And obviously, much of this has to do with the question of whether both houses of Congress go along with this or not. And they play out very differently depending on the results of that.
It's confounding how many critics the president had for his unilateral action in Libya. And how many of those same critics are now saying he waited too long by consulting with Congress in the case of Syria? Mm. How would you respond to that criticism?
I would respond privately to that criticism by saying that in many cases what we're dealing with here is political rhetoric, and this is where the politics of the situation begins to move in. We're not only talking about a president who's in his second term, but we're also talking about 435 members of the House of Representatives and 30-some-odd members of the Senate who are up for re-election in 2014. And added to that, a number of sitting members, particularly of the Senate, who plan to run for president in 2016. All of this comes into play. I think that we are playing this out in two ways. I think in the larger sense, we're playing this out in the shadow of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. with the phony information about what was and wasn't there. And I think that's feeding a lot of what we're seeing in terms of this demand for more proof, more proof, more proof. Although I have to say, I do wish that the administration would release some more information. I don't know why they're not. I'm not an expert on this, but I wish they would. I think their job might be easier if they would or could. The more focused piece of this is that we have a number of possible presidential contenders who are trying to avoid the Hillary Clinton situation when she ran for president in 2008. Certainly the first, I think, crack in that wall of inevitability was the issue of her yes vote on the invasion of Iraq. And a number of Republican contenders are trying, I think, right now to figure out whatever that vote is, how it will be interpreted 2 years from now, as opposed to how it will be interpreted now.
So it's not just the president on the hot spot.
No,
the members of Congress are there also.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a side of me that is glad that he's in his last term, because my hope would be he will not make a decision on the basis of another election. He'll make it on the basis of his own conscience.
That, I think that's true to some extent, but we have to remember that while the pressure for re-election is no longer there, the final political pressure, maybe mm-hmm. final, maybe not, but one of the political pressures that remains is any president wants as his final act to pass on the presidency to someone in his own party.
I hate to mention this, I really do, but we've seen some really ugly extremist talk about all of this. Rush Limbaugh speculated that the administration had a hand in deliberately causing the chemical attack in Syria. I never thought he could go that far.
Well,
others have dismissed the entire matter as a quote, a distraction from Obamacare. Is it crazier than it's ever been out there?
The simple answer, I think, is yes. And I think as we are, as a nation, I think finding ourselves further and further apart from each other in so many ways, this kind of rhetoric plays to very specific audiences who actually do feed on this stuff. There does seem to be so much more of it. But we continue to be very increasingly splintered, I think, yeah. as a society, which is very distressing.
What do you think it's been like in the White House the last few days?
I'm sure that it's been very, very stressful. I think there's probably been more than one shouting match, second-guessing on a number of fronts, trying to figure out where they should be, where they need to be. I've no doubt about it.
Can you see any scenario in which the president comes out of this without being hurt?
Actually, I do. I think that if I were a betting man, and I'm not, but if I were, I would probably put money on both houses of Congress. We're going to go through a lot of machinations and twists mm-hmm. and turns before we get there. But I think that in the end, both houses will probably sign on to this, probably mm-hmm. by very narrow margins. And as I said, after a lot of nasty rhetoric has been thrown around.
Yeah.
And I think that if the president gets that, it does enhance his position on an international level. And to some extent, it certainly doesn't hurt him on the domestic level as well. Then the next big question is, do we succeed in what we're about to do? And that we won't know until we're there.
Yeah. And that's a whole nother discussion.
Yep.
Greg LaBelle is a veteran of numerous presidential campaigns and our go-to guy on the workings of Washington. Greg is assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, where I'm sure this is going to be one action-packed semester for him. Mm-hmm. Greg, thank you for being with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Wilton.
For decades, writer John Shore has been involved in pushing back against the misconception that LGBT people have to choose their sexuality or their faith. That's a myth. But that's a myth that gets reinforced every time a culture war story on TV features the inevitable far-right fundamentalist commentator, as if religion in America could ever possibly speak with one voice. Well, John Shore has partnered with Truth Wins Out and Dan Savage to launch a brand new website called Not All Like That. And I'm very pleased to welcome John Shore to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
How did you come to be an activist at the intersection of God and gays?
Well, I am straight, and I had an adult conversion experience when I was 38 years old. It happened to me suddenly and out of nowhere, and up until the moment that did happen to me, I could not have been less of a Christian, insofar as I had no interest in Christianity, and I want to say almost no respect for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then, suddenly, I was a Christian.
Huh.
Up until that point in my life, I had always had gay friends. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My father was an actor, and so I just had always had around me gay people. The idea that becoming a Christian meant that I suddenly had to condemn morally who my friends were actually born to be, who they were, was anathema to me. It didn't make any sense at all. I knew it was wrong, and I began doing the work that I've been doing for quite a long time now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of work had you done on this issue before launching this website? I know that you've written a book titled Unfair, Christians and the LGBT Question.
I have a very, frankly, popular blog at johnshore.com, and I began writing there about 7 years ago in posts that were rather aggressively challenging the idea that to be anti-gay essentially was anything but biblical.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to put out challenges to Christians for all the very good reasons that they should rethink the accepted truth that the Bible condemns gay people. Over a bit of time there, Dan Savage began to become aware of my work and began to champion it here and there in his world. And I sort of became his go-to Christian for the gay people who were coming into his world and decrying the harshness with which they were being dealt with by their usually Christian families.
Mm-hmm.
What ended up happening is I ended up getting a lot of letters in from gay Christians asking for my advice or my input, and I began answering those letters on my blog. And then a community sort of built up around that work on my blog. And all of that work just naturally sort of evolved into the launching of the Nault Christians Project.
I know you are working in cooperation with Truth Wins Out. Not all of our listeners may know that organization, so I wish you would describe it and then talk about how you got into cooperation with them.
So Truth Wins Out is a organization founded by a man named Wayne Besson, and his associate director is named Evan Hurst. And Truth Wins Out is a non-faith-based group whose mission is to call attention to all the times in the media where religious extremism is being used as a weapon against gay people. That's essentially what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we were sort of natural partners in that, and they, too, have long been tracking my work and have been friends of my work. And one night, I and Evan Hurst, the associate director of TWO, were emailing. I was sharing with him the truth that gay-affirming Christians had no platform. They had no place to share with the world their conviction that being a biblical Christian did not mean being an anti-gay bigot, basically. And he had just that night been to see Dan Savage speak. And Dan Savage that night had said what Dan Savage at that point was saying quite often to the inevitable Christian in his audience, who would stand up and say, you know, Dan, we're not all like that. We don't all hate gay people. Lots of we Christians affirm gay people, don't recognize that there's anything inherently sinful about homosexuality. And Dan said, yes, I have a name for Christians like you, and it's called, you're a Nault Christian. You're a not all like that Christian, because you're saying we're not all like that. And Evan was like, we should have a website called, you know, Nalt Christian's website. And we were like, boom, that's the idea.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
That's how we started putting it together.
Well, as a religious leader with an inclusive ministry myself, I am deeply troubled and not a little bit annoyed that people of faith are routinely typecast as being anti-gay. What do you think is the cause of welcoming voices having such a hard time getting heard?
Well, because the right, for lack of a better word, and again, I don't really like to use words like right and left and conservative and liberal, because the truth is there are affirming Christians along the spectrum of left to, mm-hmm. to right within mm-hmm. Christianity and across all denominations. But for the sake of convention, we'll just talk about right and left and conservative and liberal. So the problem with the left, with the affirming Christians, with LGBT-affirming Christians, is they have lacked a platform. Because the right, these people such as Pat Robertson, mm-hmm. Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, Brian Brown and Maggie Gallagher of the National Organization for Marriage, these people understand the attraction of bashing mm-hmm. anybody, bashing mm-hmm. gay people. These people profit in the hectoring of gay people. So, of course, the media pays attention to them. It's a sensationalistic, attention-getting. You're looking at sort of, raw, kind of ugly bigotry in the guise of a religious piousness. That's just automatically attractive to the media. So, of course, the media gives that perspective its time. And the more reasonable, thoughtful, actually biblical Christian gets ignored.
Mm-hmm.
All the normal, thoughtful, reasonable, contemplative, real biblical Christians are at home, mm-hmm. or they're in their church, or they're in their study groups. The crazy Christians are on TV.
that's kind of the way it works.
It is. So,
yeah, that's kind of the way it works.
And I think it was really important to give a platform to LGBT-affirming Christians. And not so much because I want to talk to the right. I'm not really interested in talking to the Maggie Gallaghers of the world. Those people aren't really going to listen to this kind of reason anyways. The purpose of the Nalt Christians Project is to talk to the great many Christians out there now who are in the discernment process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really interested in demonizing the right. I have a good heart, a good strong heart for Christians who are simply trying to follow the Bible. They believe in the Bible. They believe the Bible is the Word of God, and they've been taught that the Bible condemns homosexuality.
Yeah.
So what I find is that Christians like that are struggling right now between what they think is a choice they need to make. And they think that choice is, on the one hand, the Bible, which is to say, in many ways, their faith, and on the other hand, their natural, loving compassion.
Mm-hmm.
They believe those two things are existing in opposition, and they're trying to understand how it can be that they're not. The Nalt Christian Project shows them how they're not.
Yeah, I've been fortunate that some media people like Rachel Maddow and Anderson Cooper have let me talk about this on television. I always feel good about it. I think you're going to give some people an opportunity to feel really good about saying what they say to somebody who really needs to hear what they have to say.
I think so. I mean, we're really looking to give people as much conviction about the truth that the Bible does not condemn gay people as do so many of those Christians who hold the opposite point of view.
Yeah.
I am tired of Christians on the left, which is to say gay-affirming Christians. I'm really tired of the idea that such Christians like me, are somehow less Christian.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we're playing loosey-goosey with the Bible, that we don't love the Bible as much as any Christian in the world, that we're not as true right. to the Bible as any Christian in the world, is something that I feel has really played its course. That whole perspective needs to stop. And so one thing I like about the Nalt Christians Project is it puts Christians like me, for once, on the offense. We are coming out and saying clearly and boldly to anybody who is interested in this subject at all that not only is it possible to be a devoutly biblical Christian and be LGBT-affirming, it's an inevitable consequence. Saying that somebody is a homosexual says nothing to you about who they are morally. That's the false argument that the right constantly puts forward, that homosexuality is in and of itself an indicator of moral status. It absolutely is not, and it's not fair to say that it is.
John Shore is co-founder of a new website offering messages of welcome and inclusion from people of faith to LGBT persons at www.notalllikethat.org. Add your voice. Let them hear. John, congratulations on it and continued success in it.
Thank you, friend. I really appreciate that.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Thank you so much. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You'll find out more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We encourage you to tell others about the show. They missed something today if they didn't hear it. You need to encourage them to listen, to find out about people like Bill Vindley and the work of Religions for Peace. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.